Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of chronic myeloid leukemia in the later line setting. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with CML share their perspectives on the later line treatment options, minimizing toxicities, and maximizing quality of life in patients with the disease. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Novartis. In this podcast, a hematologist and a pharmacist explore the later line treatment options for chronic myeloid leukemia, including T315I mutation positive disease, in a case-based discussion.
Hello, everybody. My name is Professor Andreas Hochhaus, and I'm the head of the Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Jena University Hospital here in Jena in Germany. And I'm joined today by Dr. B. Kim Tan. She is a pharmacist and senior lecturer at the School of Pharmacy in the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences at Talos University in Malaysia. And we will discuss together the question, what are the later line treatment options for patients with CML? Hello, B. Kim. It's nice to have you here, Professor. For our discussion. I remember very well when imatinib was introduced in the treatment of CML 20 years ago. And this was a major revolution, of course. We had a new drug available which changed completely the outcome of our patient. And for the first time, except a few patients who got a good response on interferon, we produced deep molecular remissions. And we defined it first as major molecular remission, and we introduced quantitative PCR to measure it. But then, very shortly after the introduction of imatinib, we have seen resistances. And these resistances were mainly in patients who had a long-standing disease. That means a bulk of CML cells in their body. And some of these CML cells got mutations. And this was a major problem at that time. That means a big research area. Where do these resistances come from? And how can we address them? And of course, new drugs were introduced into the therapy. And now we have at least 5 drugs in most countries available for the therapy. But we should find out at which stage which drug should be used, when should we switch a drug, and we want to discuss this today. For that, we have a case. And this case report shows you a 70-year-old man who has resistance to imatinib, and now, recently, also resistance to dasatinib. He has a Ph-positive CML in chronic phase, in the background, cardiovascular disease, poorly controlled hypertension, a high SoCal risk. Now we use ELTS. It's a more modern risk score, the UTOS long-term survival score, but he is high risk for ELTS as well. And his concomitant medication are only antihypertensive drugs, nothing else. And sequencing of the BCR-ABL gene demonstrated a T315I mutation. How should we deal with this case? What is your first question, Bikim?
Yeah, thank you, Prof, for having me for this case discussion. We will usually conduct careful questioning to verify or to sort of rule out poor adherence before we actually order the mutation test. Like in our center, we actually have to send the order out from the institution to sometimes to Singapore and so on to conduct the test. So that's what we usually do. We verify the adherence first.
But even if the patient is adherent, he can develop a mutation. But we know that in the non-adherent patient, a mutation development is more frequent. And if a patient has two resistances, of course, without any problems towards the patients, it's of course a sensitive question. Are you adherent or not? How do you do that? How do you ask the patient in which way whether he is adherent or not?
I do agree. It's a sensitive question, and usually what we do is we will check the prescription refill record. You know, whether the patient actually refilled their medication on time and so on. And yeah, from there we will have an idea. And of course, when we meet the patient, we will actually have a very late-dated questionnaire, the Moriski scale. So the reason for the interview is more to find out the reason, whether it's intentional, non-adherent, or it's unintentional.
Okay, and you find out the patient was adherent. Our next question is, my next question from the physician's point of view is co-medication. Can you help us from the pharmacy to find out whether the co-medication, which was probably prescribed by a different doctor outside of our hospital, has an impact on the metabolism of the tyrosine kinase inhibitor?
Yeah, we know that these TKI, most of them are heavily metabolized by the liver enzyme, cytochrome P450 enzyme system. And some of them are also the substrates, of the drug transporter, P-glycoprotein and so on. So we will medication use review will be a must as well. And we will obtain the medication list of the patient first by, calling the care site where the patient is receiving treatment for their comorbidities, or sometimes we do brown bag. Yeah.
What do you think about drug levels? From my perspective, I don't see a real benefit on the drug levels. We have the PCR available. Mm. We know where we are with the treatment. And if we ask these questions, which we just discussed, adherence and co-medication, I think we are in a good position and can go on with our treatment. I personally, in my practice, don't need the drug levels, only for research, but not for real life.
So fully agree with you, Prof.
Now we have the 315 mutation. What can we do with these patients? We could stop all tyrosine kinase inhibitors because they select this mutation or cells with this mutation. But we have now, of course, the chance to introduce drugs which inhibit the 315 mutation. Nilotinib is not available here because it does not act against this mutation. Also, bosutinib. Mm-hmm. But we have ponatinib available. Mm-hmm. Ponatinib was introduced about 10 years ago, and the early trial have shown that it produces a lot of cardiovascular side effects. Now this patient has cardiovascular disease. That means, mm-hmm. is it advisable to give ponatinib?
The results from the phase trial found that the ponatinib is associated with cardiovascular event in about 30-31% of recipients. And recently, the result of OPTIC trial published last year proposed a response-based dosing strategy. It's pretty new to sort of like improve the benefit-risk ratio by lowering the daily dose of ponatinib to 15 milligrams a day upon achieving the complete cytogenetic response. To sort of like reduce his CV event risk. Yeah. So,
but since this patient has already a cardiovascular disease, I would actually start with 30 milligrams and not give the full risk as a balance between risk and expected benefit. I would start with 30 milligram and reduce in case of less than 1% BCR-ABL levels. Which alternative drugs are available or in development? That's of course the question here. We have alternative, the most important alternative drug, which is already registered in the United States, but not in other countries, is asciminib. Asciminib is a very specific BCR-ABL inhibitor. That means has no off-target efficacy and no off-target impact. But of course, the BCR-ABL inhibition is very good, even in the case of threonine 315 isoleucine mutation. But we have other drugs which are in development for 315 mutations. Most importantly, this drug vodobatinib, which is in a phase one study, and also a drug which is only in Russia in development, PF114, in a phase one study. This drug shows skin toxicity, which was not expected, actually, according to the reports at the ASH meetings. But we have alternatives available, and I think the most important drug on the horizon. It's more than the horizon. It's available actually in most countries in studies, but also registered from the FDA is asciminib.
I see. All right. Yeah. Yeah. So, Prof, can I ask a question? So now we will the rest of the world will likely have access to asciminib. Once this drug passed a regulatory review in different country, it has proven efficacious against T315I mutation, and from phase 3 study, it shows acceptable tolerability, as well as a few other new TKI in early clinical development. So, what do you see the role of stem cell transplant for patients with chronic phase CML? At this setting, later line setting?
I think that's a very important question. Of course, for our case, 70-year-old men, that's out of the range. That means we cannot consider stem cell transplantation in such a patient with comorbidity. But in a younger patient who has resistance to two different tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and most importantly, for patients who have additional chromosomal aberrations above the Philadelphia chromosome, we should consider stem cell transplantation in the third line setting. That means this needs to be discussed with the patient because the overall outcome of patients with two resistances in the background is, of course, different from the outcome in first line. And if you want to cure CML, we should discuss the allogeneic stem cell transplantation at this specific stage after resistance to two lines of therapy. In some patients, I would also start the discussion after resistance to the first line therapy.
Agree. Yeah, I also agree. Yeah, it's important to have these options in line. Yeah, that we can offer to patients at the later line treatment to improve their outcome. Yeah, whenever the patient needs it. Yeah.
Absolutely. We are in a very fantastic situation. And I think with a discussion with the patient, with pharmacists, we will find the best way to treat each individual patient.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget, there are 3 other chapters in this series. So please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.